radio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T1 and 20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Glenn Osanek, and today we are talking to filmmaker, documentarian, I guess that's the proper word, John Edgington. Thank you very much, John, for taking time to speak to me today.
No problem. Yeah, I'm delighted, Len.
So I came across some of your documentaries almost by accident. I was just browsing for something, and you had an interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, and it was a whole documentary that was on the BBC, I think, about Martin Luther King assassination. And then I looked onto your channel, and then you had some Chappaquiddick and many things that I had seen, I think, on the A&E channel back in the day that were taken from BBC. And then I go down and I see there's a whole host of interviews of music, famous musicians, but big time interviews. And it's like you hit the mother load if you're interested in some of these things, right? So goodness, I thank you, first of all, for your good work. And I wanted to help people know a little bit more about you and just help promote your channel, because you have so many good. So I guess the first question, what got you behind the idea of making documentaries? Because that was sure.
Yeah. I started out as a journalist, and I always thought of myself as a journalist, as sort of investigative, perhaps, looking for sort of burrowing away into stories. I was working as a print journalist in the early 80s. I got into getting involved with putting together a series for a new television station in the UK, Channel 4. And Channel 4 had a kind of reputation when it was starting for promoting kind of independence and, politically maybe left of center, less kind of mainstream than BBC and so on. So, I sort of stumbled into what became filmmaking, and I saw it as journalism and slowly began to realize, oh, okay, what we're doing here is actually creating documentaries. Yeah, so I got my big sort of breakthrough in a way as a documentary maker was, I made the odd short film and the odd kind of interesting like character study. But the big thing was in 1989, I decided to see whether I could get to interview James Earl Ray and build a film around the assassination of Martin Luther King. So being an independent freelance, you really have to sort of take your chances. I got a new credit card in the mail and I thought, okay, let's go to Memphis, I worked out Ray was in prison in East Tennessee, Brushy Mountain Prison, near Knoxville, quite a long way from Memphis. I contacted the prison and I wrote to Ray and said, will you speak to me if the prison lets me in, And I can tell you about my idea for a program. He came back to me in a letter to London saying pretty much, I'm not really doing much around here at the moment, so anytime you want to call by, kind of thing. And the prison agreed that I could meet him, right? There was no filming or anything like this. It was just you're allowed to come and meet the guy and talk to him. I spent 4 hours with James Earl Ray, not with any security whatsoever. Which slightly puzzled me, as this guy was supposed to be kind of like the assassin of Martin Luther King, potentially pretty dangerous character, you would have thought he was. But, you know, by the time I'd finished talking to him, I kind of thought, yeah, it just doesn't. I had developed this idea that he was probably a patsy. But the more you kind of talk to him, the more you realized, you know, it doesn't really add up, this idea of Ray being an accurate shot and being in the right place at the right time and so on. You know, we can go into all of that. But the result of it was I managed to persuade the BBC, and I don't know how on earth I did it, but I think they thought it was a scoop to get in to talk to Ray. So they said, okay, we'll fund a sort of short documentary. This became, you know, it was a sort of 70-minute film, a lot longer than they thought it was going to be, but they were very, I think, quite impressed by it. Took me about 6 months with a colleague, great researcher, friend, John Sargent. We just spent weeks traveling around the US trying to pin down all the names. Dr. Bill Pepper was just becoming involved in Ray's case. Ray initially didn't tell me about Bill Pepper at all. He told me about a bunch of other lawyers. Bill was almost came across him by accident. And then Ray was like, oh, yeah. Well, there is Bill Pepper. Yeah. He's sort of interesting. He's kind of got involved a bit. But, yeah. You know, Bill. And along the way, this is the point that you're where we get to Fletcher Prouty, because what we were looking at was, I guess, the sort of idea that the local police, the FBI, the CIA, you know, to what extent was there a conspiracy? To what extent was the kind of idea of
an organization, not one man?
Right, exactly. And to what extent was the government involved, essentially? And Prouty seemed to be a fantastic kind of source of information and from his intelligence role in the Pentagon. Fascinating guy. And so we ended up meeting Prouty. And that was the interview that you spotted on my channel,
yeah.
I think, which got you into the channel. And I only recently retrieved that interview because all this stuff, you know, this film was shown once in 1989, once on A&E in America, actually the History Channel. It got nominated for an Emmy or an international Emmy, which got attention, but no, you know, in those days, it wasn't like there's no YouTube. There was no secondary
screenings. Yeah, cable. You either watched cable. Or you
that
didn't.
That was it. You yeah. saw it. That was it. It was done and dusted one night. So it took, frankly, years before I started to see the value in the interviews, apart from the actual documentary. And the interviews themselves were shot on film. The film had been junked by the BBC lab, but I managed to keep like ridiculous VHS copies of this film, the film rushes. And essentially what I dug out, I mean, I think earlier this year, actually, the Prouty interview.
Yeah.
Digging out these old VHSs and seeing what was on them.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it's actually viewable. You can can hear him, you know, it's pretty good. So I sort of stitched that together with some of the original stuff in the movie.
Yeah, I was very appreciative that you had that. And for people who never heard Fletcher speak, I mean, I collected a lot of his stuff, so it wasn't new to me, but just the idea, here's another interview, and here's something else. And every time someone speaks to you, hear something new, even though you've heard maybe something else before about it. Some of these other interviews, like the Chappaquiddick one, I remember watching that. I think it was Bill Curtis that hosted it.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And there was several on that A&E channel that he said, if you didn't believe that the government was involved in something, you didn't see last week's show. You know, here's part two.
Right.
and that one is equally amazing. But I'm so glad that you had just that clip of Fletcher. And then the whole who killed Martin Luther King, the assassination. I mean, you've got the word deep state, you know, maybe back then people didn't believe it. They weren't so think in that, but now it's
it wasn't referred to in that particular phrase, was it?
No, no.
I put deep state into my YouTube headline as a kind of, you know, calling card to people who are interested in that, in that whole, because Fletcher was talking about essentially the deep state, and all the things that Fletcher wrote about in his book, The Secret Team. You know, there is a lot of attempts to undermine what he said, to kind of a lot of disinformation around it, I think, you know, negative stuff about Fletcher's association with the Scientologists later in his life. You know, I don't think any of that really takes away from the absolutely central message that he conveyed in that book.
And he just lifted the cover, the lid. He said, by the way, I work there. There's a whole lot more, but here's just a little tidbit so you should consider.
Right.
And that's what I take away from him. And if you've read The Secret Team, and then there's even a follow-up book, which is called Understanding Special Operations, in which David Ratcliffe interviewed him, and to say, you spoke about this, can you elaborate? And that's where I came across Fletcher, and it was like groundbreaking for me. I thought, well, here's a guy who worked there, and he worked there for 9 years, and here's the little bit that he feels safe enough to talk about, you know, if you want to read between the lines. So I would encourage people, if you watch your interview with him, what we know now about where you think, oh, I mean, just when they threw James Earl Ray's with his radio with the cell number on it and the gun and the thing down there, it's like, oh, are you kidding me?
The bundle.
Yeah. and anyway, we don't have to go into all that. I just wanted to talk about you. Now, people can watch that, but also a majority of your documentaries are with musicians and real worthwhile interviews. And that's why I also wanted to help make sure that people know. I'm going to make a link to your YouTube channel, which is John Edgington Documentaries.
Yes.
But there are several here with around Pink Floyd, Roger Waters, David Gilmour, Rita Coolidge. And some of these are great because it's David Gilmour unfiltered, or it's the complete unedited Roger Waters, as well as other interviews that are worth note. But
yeah, I did two documentaries about Pink Floyd, and those, one was in 2001. The second was in 2012. And the unedited, unfiltered interviews take that I, you know, essentially it's the entire thing. There it is. I put the whole lot up there. You know, it's warts and all. It's sort of fluffs and off.
Yeah.
You know, background chat. And it's all there. So you get a real sense of these people themselves.
Yeah, you know, that's the over coffee different. Talk is what's really interesting. Yeah.
It's different from the kind of, the thing is that I always resisted was when they say, okay, we'll give you half an hour. So, you know, you're locked into a room with a publicist and a lawyer and the musician. And the guy is like, you know, he's already done three or four interviews that day.
Yeah.
And that to me is the death of, you know, I won't even go there. I'm not going to allow that. And they always say, oh, no, you know, David would never let you into his house or anything. Believe you and me, he did. He let me into his studio barn in the country, and he wouldn't let us leave. He was so interested in the whole interview and the books that I had with me that, I think we were there for 3 or 4 hours in the end. This was going to be like an hour, you know, kind of at home.
They're one of a kind, and certainly the fact, when I think of the press these days, with Joe Rogan having these long form interviews where you're not cut off. So like, I'm sorry, earlier today I said, hey, we got half an hour. So now I'm funny, but I just wanted to pick a time to let you know that I don't have a constraint. But Genesis, there are so many here that I'm going to urge people just to click on the link here and just thumb through there, because they're really, I mean, even I was listening to Randy Newman just talk about, you know,
versions
of his song. And so you really have captured a lot of artists talking about their craft. And, you know, not with the publicists. Oh, you can't talk about that. Don't bring up this. Don't, you know, so that's exactly. What I found of interest. And,
well, that's great. Geez, I'm so glad you loved that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. John Mersheimer, there's an interview there you just put up, I guess, because you thought it was important. But, yeah, I do. I found a real value in looking at these old interviews that were kind of behind the scenes. And like I said, when I first saw that you had captured Fletcher Prouty, then, let me see what else he's got. And then Roger Waters and Genesis and Genesis behind and the Chappaquiddick one. And I was like, oh, I remember that, but I couldn't find it again. And now you have, you know.
Well, with the Chappaquiddick one, this is because people got so interested in this. This is one of the biggest surprises to me. I think I put this interview out, the documentary up.
Yeah.
I made it for the BBC as an independent, so I had the rights to it. Mm-hmm. But A&E also, you know, so Bill Curtis kind of, they were allowed to, for a price, I imagine the BBC charged them a price to sort of, they could
licensing their fee,
own stamp on it.
Yeah.
But what I did was put up, it's almost like the Bill Curtis version, which is 90 minutes. BBC version, I was restricted to an hour. So we got 90 minutes and I voiced it instead of Bill Curtis. So I kept, so it is my kind of director's cut. And a lot of people have never seen that, you know, especially in the UK. So they're fascinated by all the extra stuff that's in there that wasn't in, and extra people too, as a result. And so, you know, I went down the rabbit hole. I looked up some of the original tapes and I found, you know, the interview with the Boiler Room Girl, for instance. So I put up pretty much the whole of that interview. You know, a few key characters that people are saying, oh, tell us more about that, you know, like, or the whole question of why was there no autopsy? So I did a whole little piece on why did they never have an autopsy on Mary Jo Kopechne? And all the theories around, you know, what was the family up to and what were the Kennedys up to and why didn't that happen? Yeah, so what you're getting in a way is what I hadn't realized before is that people are interested in all the raw material. Whereas, you know, you make a documentary, you put it all together, it's like edited short pieces put together in a film, there's a film, and the people go, well, I'd like to hear more about that guy. I want to know more about that. So I'm kind of giving them the backstory and the detail that they never really got from the film. You know, it's kind of like the alternative Wikipedia on it, you know, some film version of
forget Wikipedia. I mean, it even reminds me of, there was just something, I think 2-3 weeks ago where Kamala Harris had a 60-minute interview, but then they only released 45 minutes and it looked like they changed some of the answers around the questions. Like, that's not what she said in the first, and it was like, what? And so to this day, you don't know if you can trust a mainstream interview where here you see the cameras rolling and there's no interruptions.
Exactly.
Or if the guy drops a, you know, cup of coffee or something, it's all there. And then here's what the real opinion is. It doesn't have to be the truth. Like, you know, I think with the Chappaquiddick thing, it's like, what do you mean? That's not quite the official story we heard.
Right.
You know, it can't, and we'll leave it at that. But I urge everyone to watch that. I think people, you know, tuning into Black Op Radio will have that automatic interest and be in case they missed some of these interviews. But many of them are musicians. So if you were a fan of Genesis, Phil Collins, Pink Floyd, any of the members of Pink Floyd, there's lots there. And I even started watching the interview of, short people, Randy Newman, just talking about how a song morphed and somebody else did it. And then somebody, and you know, and I just found it of interest, you know. Now that's me. Other people who aren't crafting songs or musicians, they might say, well, what the hell's that? Right. I don't want to hear how they made the movie. I just want to watch it. Right. But, In your case, I just want to make sure that for sure I tried to promote this good channel of the good work that you had been doing, but now you are including director's cuts or outtakes or, you know, like you say back then, even if you didn't have a VCR, if you missed it, like when The Man Who Killed Kennedy came out, that was a big deal. Every Friday, we went to someone's house that had that channel and we all were around and it was like, wow, did you see that? Okay, we're coming back next week. And it was like several weeks in a row. And with the A&E stuff,
that was the Nigel Turner film, right? The Nigel Turner series.
No, I know that, but it was very similar.
It was very influential with me. It came out before I made Who Killed Martin Luther King. And I love that film. So, I'm not ashamed to say I was very much influenced by it, by the way he made it and the sort of rigor of the investigation.
Well, I think what we find of interest is you read a report, and then if someone goes to interview these people, they say, well, that's not exactly how I said it. Like, they wrote that down, but here's what happened, or here's what I saw, you know? We'll leave it at that.
Eyewitness. I mean, the thing about Fletcher Prouty, in a way, he's the authentic eyewitness inside the Pentagon. You know, I've always loved to find the actual eyewitness because all through the Martin Luther King assassination story, for instance, everybody contradicts the official version all the way through. I mean, it's absolutely uncanny.
Yeah.
You get to meet the person who saw something and they tell you something entirely different from what you were led to believe. Another film I'd just like to mention is Mumia Abu-Jamal, Case for Reasonable Doubt. It's a film I made for HBO, which the Fraternal Order of Police tried to get banned.
You have my interest.
Mumia is a Black American. He was a radio journalist in Philadelphia in 1982. He was arrested and charged with the murder of a policeman in the small hours of the morning. And his case is a huge, injustice, which has gone on to this day. And that once I got into that story, it's just a mind-boggling indictment of the American justice system in relation to particularly a Black journalist who's saying things about the establishment in Philadelphia that they didn't like to hear. If anyone looks it up and watches it, it's on, the whole film is on the channel. And I'm very proud of that film.
What was the title again?
It's called Mumia Abu-Jamal, A Case for Reasonable Doubt, ?
All right, I'm going to watch that for sure.
Yeah.
Because there is quite a few. I mean, how many? Do you have any idea how many interviews you have?
Well, I think there's something like 150 videos, something like that.
Wow.
Some of them are shorter than, some are long, some are short. Amazingly, I mean, some of these interviews are running to nearly 2 hours. But if you like a short, quick, I'm also giving people kind of 10 minutes, 20 minutes, selections as well.
I mean, Storm Thurgeson.
Yes.
Artwork, Okay, looks like it says running low on time. Okay, no problem. Is there any other things, favorites that you recommend people really should watch here? With 150, it'll take people a few times to go through, I think, and find someone. Yeah. They're all interesting.
Okay, I was going to say a quick shortcut is if you look at the playlists on the channel, so there's a playlist called Secret History, which is all the political history documentaries, including the Chappaquiddick and the Martin Luther King and so on. And then there are different playlists for each group of musicians. So Pink Floyd, Syd Barrett is a separate playlist. Genesis, Phil Collins is a separate one. David Gilmour has a separate, and Roger Waters has a separate. And I did a film about Joe Cocker, which is a bunch of people in that, like Randy Newman and Rita Coolidge. So I put up some of their interviews as well. Yeah.
Oh, very good. I didn't know that. So thanks for the tip. That is also helpful.
Great.
All right. So are you retired from filmmaking now, documentaries, or?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if I know the answer.
Oh, very good. That's a good answer.
Yeah.
That's me too. I keep thinking I should retire from stuff. And I go, well, you know, I'm still doing it. So
yeah, exactly.
Anything you're working on then in the, that would be of interest?
I'm still helping other filmmakers work on things. I got very involved in a film about the history of New Orleans music made by a friend of mine in New Orleans. It's called Up From the Streets. If anyone wants to look it up, it's on Prime, Amazon Prime. Great film. Fantastic history of New Orleans music.
I'll try to make a link for that.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned Bill Pepper. I knew Bill Pepper pretty well.
And, yes.
I made a documentary of his life with John Barber.
And oh, yeah.
I may have
seen that. I think I've seen everything pretty much.
Oh, okay.
Bill was a good friend. I used to meet him.
Yeah.
You know, every month we would meet for lunch in New York.
So I made an album of anti-war poetry with him. So he had all these poems. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yes, he did.
And you know, it took me about 4 years, but he phones me one day and he goes, "Well, I'm in San Francisco. I can get up to Vancouver by 11 o'clock. You want to do it?" Because I had a professional voiceover guy narrate the poems for the, you know, just the tempo and the delivery. And then I wanted Bill to do that. So we did that. And I also just finished a documentary on Fletcher Prouty. So,
oh, really?
I'll send you a link for that because it's
please.
So
do.
Glad that you mentioned even Bill Pepper because he was behind the scenes there too.
Oh, he's great. Bit of a hero, really, Bill. The interview that I did with him for in 1989 for that film, which is lovely, and he's very sort of fresh faced and energized, and he's really at the beginning of his quest to get Ray, you know, new trial. I've just dug that out off the old VHS, and I was looking at it yesterday, so I'm going to try and put that up quite soon.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
All right, John, I think we're getting around to wrap up. Is there anything you'd like to bring up that I didn't get to or you do want to mention?
No, I just want to thank you very much, actually, Len. It's great to get an enthusiast. I often, you know, you put up a video, it just goes out into the world. You have no idea who's going to watch it. And it's great to get the attention of someone like yourself, who's got, you obviously have a rounded take on, you know, politics, music, a bunch of interests. You're a musician yourself, aren't you?
Yeah.
I thought you were. Yeah.
So yeah, but who knows what our interest falls? But I really enjoyed the Fletcher Prouty stuff, the Martin Luther King, the Bill Pepper, anything. All those, and the thing is that your work, it. As you dug into each witness and things, you said, well, this is not what the official report is. This is not. So that's what a real reporter and a documentary helps come out. You don't just say, here's the facts, Ray didn't do it. You say, well, we got on the trail and we're going to take you with us on this little journey to realize that at the end you come to this conclusion. They're lying about this. And even the fact that 60-odd years later in the JFK assassination. They do not want to release the documents that are all... I mean, because it's the same thing with so many things. Even when I heard about Pfizer wanted 75 years before they released their stuff. There's a documentary of somebody, a topic. They said, what did Pfizer really know? And, you know, and did it really work? Was it safe and effective? And that's a different topic.
That's a good one. We'll
leave it at that. But I really appreciate finding all your good work. And I want to make sure that a lot of people knew about your channel. And hopefully friends of mine on Facebook will see this. And even if they're not interested in the politics like that I am, you find some of these interviews of your heroes talking just, you know, over coffee like we are, but you really get a sense of the person.
Yeah, exactly. I always said my final parting word is, if they don't want you to see it, then you need to know why, and you need to try and open the box, you know, lift the lid.
Yeah.
Get to the bottom of why they don't want you to see it. And that's always been the kind of modus operandi, really. You know, if you keep asking, the whole basis of, we went to the FBI Freedom of Information so many times during the making of a bunch of those films. And then you get these documents. In the case of the CIA and Martin Luther King, all the excisions, all the lines that are drawn through.
Redacted,
all the redactions. And then you want to go, okay, so what's behind the redactions? You know, there's no freedom. There's no information that's here if it's all redacted.
Yeah.
So, keep asking the questions.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you again for sharing your time today.
Sure.
And
John
Edgington Documentaries. I'll make a link to the YouTube channel. I'll be watching that documentary you just mentioned that you said they tried to get you removed.
Okay. Great.
All right. Thank you again. Good night.
Thank you, Len. Yeah. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek, and today we're speaking to researcher, author, Ray McGinnis. I'm not sure what are the titles you'd like to go by. Author, for sure.
Sure.
I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that's good.
Where can people find more about you? Because I think you've been writing a few articles on various, you know, magazines, online magazines. I just want to make sure people can get a hold of some of those things. Where do we find you?
You can go on Twitter or X at Ray McGinnis, RayMcGinnis 7. That's one place to find me. Also, on my second book, Unanswered Questions about the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Independent Commission, which is all about the efforts of the families, the victims of 9/11, to have an investigation during the Bush administration. So unanswered questions.ca, I have numbers of articles related to interviews I had related to that book, but I've continued to post numbers of different articles that I've written about the Freedom Convoy, the blockade at Coutts, and some of the podcasts are there as well, more recent ones the last few years. So
good.
Unanswered
we'll
questions.
Make links to that. Yeah, I think when I first you came across my radar was that Unanswered Questions, and that you actually were researching stuff. And then when we heard about the protest in Ottawa with the Freedom Rally, you actually went. I mean, it was like, I feel lucky because I'm talking to somebody who walks the walk. If you say you're going to go listen to some hearings or investigate something, it's just so great that I can pick up the phone and talk to you and say, well, you know, what's new? What have you found out? I guess that's what I wanted to get to tonight, because there was a couple of things happening, and I'll just turn it over to you.
Certainly. In the past, we've discussed the protests regarding once the Canadian government put in place a vaccine mandate for truck drivers, telling truck drivers in mid-January of 2022 that if they wanted to cross back into Canada, the Canadian border, that they had to show vaccination status, and if they were not vaccinated, they had to quarantine for, I'm not sure if it's 10 or 14 days, but in either case, it would mean that a truck driver who's trying to make a living in Canada would only be able to work 2 to 3 days a month, because each time they come across the border with a load of goods, they would have to quarantine for 10 or 14 days. So there ended up being a huge protest in Ottawa and some protests and sympathy in numerous border points. You know, as a result of all of that, there was the Emergencies Act that was declared. So in Coutts, Alberta, north of Sweetgrass, Montana, there was another protest. There were two men convicted this summer. A jury found them, both Chris Carbert and Tony Olianik, guilty of mischief and of possession of weapons for a dangerous purpose, although they were not brandishing any weapons. The few weapons that they did own were legally purchased and registered, but nonetheless, they were in the vicinity of where the protest was happening in Coutts, Alberta. And then an additional thing for Tony Olianik, he was also charged with possession of an explosive device for a dangerous purpose, which I should add that explosive device was something that his father had owned and passed on to him after his father died in 2017, often used for dislodging, you know, drill bits if a drill got stuck in a stone quarry. But that explosive device was in Clarisome, Alberta, which is a 2-hour drive away from Coutts. But nonetheless, he was convicted of that charge as well. And there were the two men had served the equivalent of about, well, they've been in jail for in custody in remand center for 2.5 years, but there's a ratio of like 1.5 days served for each day because of the circumstances, because they were denied bail. And so they've got about 4 years time that they've served, but they're given 6.5 year sentences. So they have time yet to serve if they serve the full term. Now, there are families, and friends working with the lawyers that want to appeal the sentencing. And first thing is, I mean, normally you think a transcript to a trial would be, you know, part of what the general public has access to. But in this case, what they've done is I'm not sure if it's $375 or $475 per hour of court hearing transcripts, but it's quite an onerous amount, and the families had to raise over $12,000 for the transcripts, which the defense lawyers want in order to be able to work on their appeal of the sentencing. And where it stands today, because I spoke to Betty Carbert, the mother of Chris Carbert, she's in Lethbridge, Alberta. And the Lethbridge Courthouse, as I understand it, is saying that there needs to be permission from a judge to get the transcripts, which, according to Betty Carbert, is not actually true. But nonetheless, they're getting this runaround. There's financial hurdles, and then there's bureaucratic hurdles or bureaucratic stumbling. So it's not going to make the news. But when it, you know, just like this whole trial, normally, what happens if there's a serious trial, like initially they and two others were charged with conspiracy to commit murder of police officers at the Coutts blockade in February of 2022. Normally, the Crown would want to put together its case and speedily get in front of a court and show that the men are guilty as they're accusing them of. And then then they get sentenced if a jury would find them guilty or not. But in this case, they spent 2.5 years in custody without bail. So after all of that, now there's another iteration of this slow walking, what should be, you know, normal procedures in order for the next step regarding an appeal of the sentencing. So it's just another example of the kind of the lawfare that goes on now in Canada, where not only are people accused of serious crimes presumed guilty until proven innocent, but you've got this slow walking of the mechanics of justice that also makes it very difficult for anyone who's accused or even accused and sentenced to be able to.
If anybody didn't know about it, this was about making a blockade and, you know, setting up a blockade on a highway saying we're protesting these mandates, mandatory, and that's a whole other thing. But it bothered me that the trial took forever even to happen, and there was no bail, and there was just a whole mystery on what are they going to charge them with. I mean, it seemed to be, I hate to say a joke, but, you know, them talking in a bar and it's just that they were planning some overthrow of the government, you know.
Yeah, so and even in the Coutts blockade, on and off, I mean, there was disruption to slowing down of traffic, disruption of traffic crossing the border. But there were at least 8 days where the border was certainly open and free flow of traffic as a gesture of goodwill on the part of the protesters. And so, I mean, back in 2020 in Canada, there was a protest by Indigenous Canadians and others regarding a number of different issues. And that went on from early January until about the 20th of March, 2020. That involved at least 5 weeks of shutdown of rail service for both passenger and freight, as well as the blockade of a highway in Ontario, vandalism of junction boxes in several train junction points in Ontario, disruption of ferry service on and off on the west coast of British Columbia. And throughout all of it, Prime Minister Trudeau's attitude was, well, we need to understand these people and have discussions and dialogue. And so instead of that being the way to go forward with the protests over the vaccine mandates, 2 years later, it was these people are an unacceptable fringe minority. They're racist, Nazis, misogynist, homophobic, and so on. So the government took a 180 degree U-turn away from what has been a preponderant attitude of governments throughout the past century and this century up until 2022, which was to find a middle ground. If there are people protesting in Ottawa, somebody, not necessarily the prime minister, but a deputy minister, somebody will come out representing the government and have some discussion with a few people. They may reach some agreement. They may agree to disagree, but at least there's a conversation. And in this case, in 2022, there was no discussion, and the protesters were portrayed, as mercenaries, terrorists, and so on.
And meanwhile, Trudeau has a bona fide Nazi in Parliament, and he gets a standing ovation.
Isn't that ironic?
You just said that you were there for some of the trial hearings in Alberta. What struck you as being important? Usually I like hearing the things that upset me. So what were some of the things that were troubling to the general public?
Well, I mean, I was there, for several days in mid July. The defense, the Crown, finished up their words to the jury and to the judge, their case, and then the defense began. The one lawyer for Tony Oleanik, Marilyn Burns, very able. She's a civil lawyer. This was her first ever criminal case, so which is also interesting, and it's a sign that there's a lot of criminal lawyers that don't want to take a case like this because perhaps why would that be? Maybe because If you end up taking a defendant that is accused of something that it's clear that the government doesn't like what certain people were protesting about, that might harm your career as a lawyer going forward. I mean, both Keith Wilson and Eva Chipiak, who were representing some of the protesters at the Public Order Emergency Commission in Ottawa in the fall of 2022, certainly found that numbers of their clients that they'd had for years, some of the contracts they had, dried up because people didn't like that they were defending people that were part of the quote unquote unacceptable fringe minority. So in any event, there's a way in which the defense was concerned about the way in which there are overtones of politics in the case, but if the defense mentions politics, it's seen as unseemly, and the defense lawyer will get chastised for it. But if the Crown, in their final words to the jury before they're sequestered, even though the Crown is supposed to have full disclosure to the defense lawyers regarding all of what their case consists of, in its final words to the jury on, I think, the, you know, whatever the last days were in late July before the jury met for several days to deliberate, the Crown was introducing brand new information, to the very last second, which is not what you're supposed to do. It's like someone going out the door and saying, and another thing. So those kind of antics. I think also I would say that the judge's words to the jury at the end of the 8 weeks of the trial, and this is the last week of July, early August, were very much, well, you know, you have to keep an open mind and you have to be confident that beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused are guilty of what they've been charged with. Otherwise, they should be acquitted. And the judge said, you know, I've certainly changed my mind about what's going on myself. And then there was, you know, the verdict that they weren't, that the two were not guilty of conspiracy to commit murder, and which is the most serious charge. And then, you know, several weeks later, maybe 10 days later, the Crown brought forward at least a paper that they were wanting to have. They like to have a retrial, and
appeal the decision.
Appeal, but almost like saying that we need to have an appeal, but appealing, saying we want to have a new trial altogether. But it seemed that action by the Crown may have put the heat on the judge in question. I can't know, but all I can say is that when the judge came back during the week of sentencing, where they hear the Crown make some more presentations, and the defense lawyers the same regarding the case for what the sentence should be, the judge's tone was quite remarkably changed. And it seemed that it was almost as though what he was now saying was, well, even though they weren't charged with conspiracy to commit murder, he found he found some way to almost insinuate that had practically happened, but somehow the threshold had been missed by a hair. But just he said that when Chris Carbert was on the stand, it was obvious he was lying. There were numbers of people who testified, who were for the defense, that were one man who worked at the stone quarry that Tony Oleanic worked at, and the judge just dismissed the suggestion that the explosive device could have ever been used for, you know, a work-related purpose.
Yeah, well, it looked like the government failed in the whole public opinion of the mandates, and then people protesting the mandate, and by having a blockade on a highway or taking all your trucks and going to the parliament. And when they failed so badly at it, they had to kind of throw the book at whoever they could. And it seemed to me that this is what happened. This is the only people, those four people in Alberta, that they could throw the book at somehow. And two of them at least got off. But the thing was, it's just like many cases that we're hearing of, that you think like the FBI is working on your behalf or the RCMP are there to protect you, and they're working against average people. They're taking political, and you know, my whole opinion of Justin Trudeau has changed 360 degrees, kind of thing, or 180, however you want to call it, right? Just, yeah. I thought it was a breath of fresh air that he got in. His predecessor was maybe a little too stale, and here's a young guy with ideas and that. But after the pipeline and there's so many debacles, and then calling those guys Nazis and just being unwilling to even admit that, look at people talking about the medical information now. There's going to be some big lawsuits going on if you follow some of the doctors that have been coming forward with finally people getting the real facts and figures about how many adverse reactions, how many deaths were caused by the vaccine. And then the enormous effort of governments on the media to not report the truth, to cover up the story, to have just a narrative promoted regardless of the truth. And you know, thank goodness for people like Joe Rogan who said, look, I took ivermectin and 2-3 days later I was better. It was like a common cold, and I didn't feel good. But and then you go back to the whole thing about, well, you know what? You know, in a military lab they made this. This is germ warfare they're doing, and maybe they shouldn't be doing that. And then that's a whole other debate, but they said, oh, it came from a wet market. It's about when they all knew. And years later, we get these documents, we get the emails, we get the stuff that Fauci knew, they all knew, and they just stood there grinning, and it's that chuckle where you're doing the con, right? The most famous one was when the guy was asked about, with Edward Snowden, I forget the guy from the Congress or the Senate, saying, you know, do you read our emails? Do you do that? Do you intercept everything? And he goes, no, not willingly. Clapper, right? You know, it's just, well, it's enough to make you say, I want to protest, and maybe we're going to blockade a highway or something like that until they start to listen and propose regular changes. Now, usually that happens, well, it used to happen when somebody in government said, well, we don't agree with the way you're doing it. We're proposing another way. Vote for me. And so that would happen. And somebody else, I mean, I don't think there's any hope in hell that Trudeau, well, I was going to say, he might not even last until the election date, but he is just so ill thought of, just as a tyrant by other people, you know. And it's hard to think about that in Canada. You think we're nice and polite and everything should be just done above board. But the stuff these guys are trying to pull off, citizens, just average citizens, and not really sophisticated people either. That's the other thing. When you look at the truckers or the organization of that, it's a very ad hoc things, you know. Like, yeah, I feel that way too. I feel that way too, you know. And then something that you were talking about last time you were on, we were talking about Bill C-63. Where they really want to shut down the internet and curb any dissent on anything, you know, but mostly, you know, information, medical information, like the, you know, in the case of the mandatory vaccine cards and that, you know, and people would say, well, does it work? Like, do you have any proof that it actually does work? Because they said, well, was it safe and effective and all that, and they parroted that stuff, or they said, it stops the spread right away. You have your and then you, you know, and so who doesn't want that, right? But they say, well, do you have any, can you offer anything that if I go in to take this shot, it actually will do even half of what you say, you know? It, you know, everybody's different, and man, it was all the different blood types and things like that. You wonder, how can one shot just work on everyone? And now they want to have it on kids.
And that's maybe a segue to, well, yes, and of course, I mean, the government knew from the document that they signed their purchasing agreement with Pfizer on October 26, 2020, which was made public in November of 2023, that the government understood that Pfizer was telling them that the outcomes, the risks of taking the vaccines were unknown. So the whole safe and effective mantra was at best aspirational, to be generous. And now we have, I think even Health Canada now has a safety signal for myocarditis in young men and, you know, teenagers and so on. So maybe in your mentioning about the children, that kind of segues to my recently attended 3 days of the of a national citizens inquiry that happened in the suburb of Vancouver in Surrey on October 17th, 18th, and 19th. And their focus was very much on how are children doing in Canada now on this side of the pandemic. And, you know, we have a real health crisis in children. I listened to Dr. Julie Panessi, who is from Ontario, and she was, she's an ethicist, and she was talking about some of the indicators that we have, like SATS Canada has said that all-cause mortality in children has risen over just the past 5 years from 8.2 per 100,000 to 10.4 per 100,000. This is for children ages 5 to 9. And she talks about how, you know, a Center for Disease Control study in 2022 found that 75% of 12 to 17 year olds suffered an adverse event like headache, muscle pain, or elevated troponin T levels, and those T levels are associated with myocarditis. 20% for the 12 to 17 year olds were so severe that they were unable to go to work or school. I recommend the book by Edward Dowd called Cause Unknown. We're having an epidemic now of children, youth, and young, people under 40 years of age, especially men when it comes to heart issues, many people hospitalized and many people just dying suddenly, whether it's in their sleep or, you know, in the middle of a wrestling match, have a heart attack and die, or out in the football field or in the middle of a race, you know, I mean, it's just an explosion of all of this. And people may say, well, it can't be the vaccine. But what's interesting is we have this explosion in excess deaths of young people, children, youth, and people under 40 that's being noted by insurance companies because they're betting that younger people who have insurance aren't going to end up being, they can insure them because it's not going to be likely they're going to die, but now they are. And so if it's not the vaccines, then what is it? And the answer seems to be that the media and elected officials are all crickets when it comes to this. They're not interested at all in looking under that rock to understand why this is happening in the least. So, and I'll add one other thing that was interesting with Dr. Julie Panessi's presentation, that one third of Canadian children get the recommended 60 minutes of physical activity a day. So two thirds are not moving around very much. 9 to 13 year olds in Canada, ultra processed foods make up 60% of Canadian children's diets. And what's known about ultra-processed foods, you know, whether it's Captain Crunch or variety of Cheeto Lay or whatever it happens to be, is that ultra-processed foods have been shown to be linked to tooth decay, stroke, cancers, diabetes. And we know that in 2019, according to Statistics Canada, ultra-processed foods contributed to the deaths of 36,000 Canadians. So if we already knew that before the pandemic, that having a diet that relies heavily on ultra-processed foods, and what's happening to the population that has a diet that's heavily linked to that, why are we continuing to either not educate parents or you know, like we've just gotten ourselves really into a bad trajectory, because children who are on this are certainly going to end up becoming the adults that have all kinds of diabetes and other health issues. And also one thing more I'll just add, depression has doubled in children and youth compared to pre-pandemic rates. And now suicide is the third leading cause of death between 1 and 14-year-olds. So we have a whole bunch of health and mental health issues going on in Canada for our younger Canadians. And it just seems that the response in the healthcare sector of the people in positions of leadership is to say, well, you know, now, you know, let's make sure that the children as young as 6 months old or whatever get another booster or something. So, it's we seem to have an awful lot of groupthink happening and an awful lot of head in the sand.
And of course, I don't watch CNN anymore, but if you watched every second commercial was brought to you by Pfizer, brought to you by Pfizer, you know, so they just have unlimited money to just keep their narrative going about how everybody needs 8 shots and boosters and boosters, right? You know, say, well, if the first 3 or 4 shots didn't work, what am I boosting?
Yeah. I mean, who knows why? I can't drill down into it because I just heard the statistic, but Dr. Julie Panessi said in her recent presentation to the National Citizens Inquiry in Vancouver that now 1 in 4 young people in Canada say they always or often feel lonely. So, that's a big red flag, because now, of course, it may also, of course, be related to the depression that's doubled, to suicide becoming the third leading cause of death in young people. So, I don't know to what extent we can say that wearing masks, which makes it, you know, you wear masks all day long in school, day in and day out. It's a little harder to make, the facial cues that, you know, smiling and all those kind of things to figure out whether you're connecting with another person non-verbally are just really it's just, you know, they're off.
Well, it is a conundrum, you know, because the thing is that if it worked, if you said wear the mask, take the shot, and then COVID just disappeared. But now they're saying, oh, it's making a comeback. It's coming back, you know. It's just I'm so distrusting now when I hear of all these guys, especially with Robert Kennedy Jr. and some of the revelations that different doctors have come out to say, look, they just were not reporting. They were not taking seriously anything that is kind of like a parallel to what you were talking about earlier. But a lot of these cases where somebody died under some circumstances and they say they died of COVID, just put COVID down. So the numbers are inflated. And then the people who had an adverse reaction, well, we can't be sure about that. So just we're not counting that. We're not counting that. And I've heard some doctors say they had all sorts of hurdles even trying to make some of these reports that they knew were not going to, they were going against the negative, but the narrative, but they still wanted to make the reports. And, you know, you wonder if the numbers are really underreported.
Well, certainly when you have, depending on the province here in British Columbia, a first dose, you get vaccinated. If you had an adverse reaction, like I had a friend who went to the hospital within 12 hours or so, but he ended up in the hospital too soon. Anybody who got vaccinated and then ended up being in hospital, you know, as far as his family doctor was concerned and a team of specialists at GF Strong were concerned, the vaccine certainly had accelerated, quote, his clotting and created the stroke. However, in terms of what the British Columbia Center for Disease Control counts, it's not until your kind of your 22nd day post-vaccination that they start to count someone as having a vaccine injury. So, you know, I mean, people can quibble about how long it takes for a vaccine to sort of really take in terms of its robustness. But that's different than somebody getting a new medication or a new vaccine and then very quickly finding themselves in an ambulance on the way to a hospital. And so that was one way that they suppressed the information. And they also were padding the numbers. I mean, I talked to a paramedic in Ontario who had to deal with a jumper from an eighth floor and of a building. And, you know, the person, you know, landed, I think, you know, head first or something. And they were not in any shape, you know, at all. I mean, they had to use spatulas to take what was left of the person, you know, to a morgue. But nonetheless, you know, there was no intact head. But nonetheless, this paramedic got a phone call later that day from public health in Ontario informing them that the jumper had been categorized as a COVID death. You know, and the paramedic asked the official in question, well, I don't understand, like, what would you swab? There's nothing to, you can't do a PCR test on somebody who doesn't really have an intact jaw or whatever. Anyway, like, so they're padding the numbers. And I know numbers of cases of where this is so. And so, and then they're suppressing the instance of vaccine injuries by disallowing, depending on the province, anyone who happens to get vaccinated and then goes to hospital within the first 14 days or 21 days. So then you can, they can also tinker with the definition of severe reaction. If you decide that it's looking concerning for your statistics in a given province that the numbers of severe adverse events are a bit too high, then you can always do things like decide to remove Bell's palsy as a reaction in the severe category, remove Guillain-Barré disease, remove anaphylactic, you know, shock, you know, and then suddenly you can reduce the numbers by taking away whole categories of what normally would be understood as a serious situation. So I think that there's people in public health in this country that have a lot of explaining to do if and only if the mainstream media would start to report the travesty of what's been going on.
Yeah, it's troubling. But, you know, when Pfizer said they didn't want to release details of their studies for 75 years, that's what made my, you know, ears perk up. I go, what? That's like the Kennedy assassination. They don't want to release anything. And we all know, anybody who's looked into it, well, it's a whole total fraud, the Warren Commission. So, and even with the 9/11 Commission. So now Pfizer says we've got to keep this trade secrets for 75 years. We don't, you know. It's like, what gives?
And yeah, what gives? Because here we are, you know, the media are aware that the general population, a large majority of people, are getting vaccinated, different proportions in Canada from the USA. But whether it's 2/3 or 85 or 90%, It would be of interest once the Pfizer documents, once a judge in the States disagreed with Pfizer and the, was it the FDA that tried to support Pfizer in its effort to seal things for 75 years. And then out come the documents for people to see, like Dr. Naomi Wolf and others, Aaron Siri, lawyer, and so on. And they were able to show, oh, let's look at this cumulative adverse event report that Pfizer's worldwide safety branch came out with at the end of April of 2021 regarding data that Pfizer's own people had collected up until the end of February of 2021, showing that by their own estimation, 1,223 people had died as a result. Fatal was the actual category, died as a result of getting their new vaccine, in quotes. So an ethical company would, I think, say, okay, let's halt the rollout. Let's find out who the 1,223 people were that died in our reporting system in time for an autopsy or whatever else they needed to have. And the ducks in a row by the end of February 28, 2021, are there certain categories of people? You know, are there people with Crohn's disease? Like, you know, who are the people who are more at risk? Can we, is it just a crapshoot or what? But no, they said, okay, this looks bad. Let's seal this information off for 75 years. So, yeah, so there's certainly a cover up and then the media just sits on it. They don't, I mean, aside from, you know, you and others in the alternate media, but the mainstream media doesn't give it the time of day.
Russell Brand, Tucker Carlson, Joe Rogan, and there's several others now, but people that are doing good work that you go, at least I'm going to get an honest investigation there, whether I subscribe to their conclusion or not. And so I'm like that, but not with any of them, like you said, the mainstream, lamestream, downstream media, you know?
Yeah. We have a problem with the information. We're dealing with an information war, and we're also dealing with manipulation of the general public. The presentation in the media of a scary virus that maybe is going to kill maybe 50 million people by May of 2020. Of course, it doesn't end up being anything like that in the least, but there's all these images that people get to see, and so they're being scared to death, quite literally. And then, what, you know, there are people who have seemed to learn over time that if you can scare the general public, they will, when people are really scared, it's hard to move to a place and sit back and say, I'm going to be detached now, and I want to think about what I'm being told and see if there's any other information. And so when many people don't do that and instead think, I'm going to just trust the CBC, or I'm going to just trust, whatever mainstream news source, the Toronto Star. And then you have all these people going around saying that that they think that 99% of all the people in hospital are unvaccinated, for example, which was not true. But it takes a lot of time to finally happen upon a book like Regina Wattiel's book Fisman's Fraud to find out the height and depth and breadth of the fraud. Of the contention that the unvaccinated were a clear and present danger to everyone else around, and I think that the challenge for the average citizen is to find a way to rethink what we do when someone tells us something shocking and scary. It's almost like I feel like I'm back in childhood where someone's telling me the story of Chicken Little, who's running around saying the sky is falling. And then all the cows and sheep and pigs and everyone else in the farm is running around saying, you know, because they believe Chicken Little. But the lesson from that little story is that eventually people have to sit back and say, the proverbial Chicken Littles of from that story and of our day need to be questioned. We need to be able to scrutinize what they're saying. Otherwise, we're always going to be.
Yeah, well, you want some critical thinking going on. And if they had offered a vaccine, it's, you know, kind of unproven. We're under a, you know, we don't know what to do. No one knows what to do. But the thing is that when they lied on everything, it bugs me. When they lied, when they knew where it came from, they knew the weekend it came out in Wuhan, you know. And just the fact that they made it mandatory and the way that Trudeau was so unapologetic about that. Don't think you're going to get on a train or don't think you're going to get on a plane. And then I never really understood the logic that, you know, we're not going to let an unvaccinated person on. Well, all these people that took the vaccine, if they're immune, I mean, if they have, you know.
If it's safe and effective,
yeah.
You don't need it.
Yeah. No. So they're the ones that should be happy, you know.
Yeah, they should be happy. I mean, when I got my polio sugar cube as a child, I think in kindergarten, I knew that I didn't have to worry. We had a family friend. My parents had a family friend who lived in the Okanagan Valley that we visited with, you know, from summer to summer, and she had polio. But there was no need for us to worry that we were going to get polio by being hanging out with her, because we'd already gotten our polio vaccination. And that's the way vaccines are supposed to work. They're a sterilizing vaccine that prevents you from getting whatever you're vaccinated, inoculated against getting. So you know, if a bunch of, in this case, if a bunch of people are unvaccinated from COVID-19, if they're taking on some sort of a risk, it should be, if the vaccine is in fact effective, then people who've been vaccinated can just calm down and relax and carry on with their own plan to, you know, to get another booster if they feel that they need to do that. But
and if they want to, right. So what you're saying is the, once again, as a reporter, you sat in on some of these hearings in Vancouver, 17, 18, 19 of October, and people, voiced their concerns of young children being suggested they need to take this vaccine now.
Well, that's one of the, you know, one of the things is that with children, there's, you know, with the incidence of you know, from the Center for Disease Study, in the USA, with 75% of 12 to 17-year-olds suffering adverse events, and 20% having so severe that they can't go to part-time work or go to school, it would seem that there are many youth and children that are not having a great reaction to this vaccine. Now, it's also, I think, very solidly demonstrated in the literature that children and youth, I mean, the incidence of children and youth, being, you know, hospitalized as a result of COVID or dying, like, you know, even the very few reports of children that were said to have died of COVID. Actually, it was with COVID, and they had, you know, comorbidities of, you know, various cancers and so on as an 8-year-old boy or whatever it happened to be the case. So when you peel, you know, down below the surface of the shocking headline to get people stampeding to rush off to get their 4-year-old vaccinated, it seems that there's more risk to the child by getting this vaccine. Than letting them just get COVID if they do, and then have natural immunity. And natural immunity has been something that's been around since, you know, Plato or before, and it's always been understood. And yet, I mean, it's like medicine 101 for physicians in training in medical school. But somehow natural immunity got tossed out with a whole bunch of other basic things that were learned, like 30 years of studies from 1990 until 2020 showing that, well, it makes sense for a physician, a surgeon in a room to wear a mask to deal with, you know, if there's spittle or blood or anything else going on when they're doing, you know, surgery and organs of a patient that they're having to open up. It doesn't make sense, never made sense to wear a mask to deal with a respiratory virus. Why? Because the holes in the mask are 35 times at least larger than the droplets from the vaccine that can go through the mask or on the side of the mask where there's a big hole anyway. And it also didn't ever make any sense why somebody should be required to wear a mask to go into a restaurant. And then once they've sat down and ordered their food, to take off the mask and eat or drink whatever they want to for the next hour or an hour and a half, because somehow some people must believe that the COVID-19 virus always decides to have its time out when people are eating and drinking.
Right. Well, we don't have to go through that whole debate, but I'm just interested that at least you did go to this latest set of hearings where people are voicing their concerns, and yeah. We're just talking about it. And like we both said, if it was voluntary, if you said, look, I don't want to take it, I'm gonna go on the SkyTrain or city bus and I'm going to take my chances, or I'm going to wear a mask, and if it's just voluntary, that's up to you. And then we'd like to see the figures of people, how many people actually caught it and treated it like a common cold, how many people really died. I mean, there's several instances of elderly people getting, I mean, but the thing was, they never had any other, they belittled like ivermectin. I never really thought I'd ever be taking zinc. You know, we took vitamin C, okay. And they're saying vitamin D also. Okay, vitamin D, no problem. And zinc, what's zinc for? But, you know, if it's recommended, okay, fine. So people could be proactive in looking in, you know, especially with the internet these days, of deciding what, you know, to stay healthy. What can you do to stay healthy? They were arresting people, in parks and... Anyway, I don't want to get into all that. But I just did want to make sure that... got you to talk about that you were at this latest seminar where they were discussing.
Yeah, well,
at least they're coming around a bit to say, you know, this might not have been, the vaccine might not have been as rosy as we promised.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, and it's more than a seminar. I mean, it's the National Citizens Inquiry, which has been, and people can go on to the nationalcitizensinquiry.ca, I think it is, and look at the testimony.
Well, I just had the name wrong. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But, you know, there's really important, you know, they're still doing some important testimony from people who are commenting on what's been happening as Canada limps out of the pandemic. Although, of course, as you note, people are being encouraged to get another booster. We need to find some way to reflect on what's been happening. And I think that the testimony of people that's been going on at the different iterations of the National Citizens Inquiry in different places, Truro, Nova Scotia, Winnipeg, Regina, Red Deer, Vancouver, and so on, is a treasure trove of useful testimony for individuals to educate themselves about and consider what's really been happening here.
Same thought, some doctors have been coming out now and making a better presence on the internet to say that, you know, I was threatened with this, I was threatened with that, we were belittled, and we had contrary data, and now we can share it with people. Now we can tell you what we found, and it's not what the CDC was finding or in England finding. And even I think with that documentary that came out, Died Suddenly, or is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Right, you know, where it came out to morticians were saying, we're finding things. And like you mentioned with blood clots and that, like these things are up. Okay, maybe we don't have enough time to exactly put the blame on this RNA vaccine. But we're going to start looking into it. And yeah, hopefully the tide is turning where it's a level playing field, where somebody can say, here's my data, my research. What do you think of this? Before they, I mean, when they just clamped down and they would delete people's Twitter accounts and Facebook things for saying that they couldn't even talk about where it came from.
Well, certainly when it comes to, I mean, one of the people that testified at a previous National Citizens Inquiry in Red Deer, Alberta, was Dr. Gregory Chan. He talked about the challenge of reporting serious adverse events on the health system in the reporting system that's established. And, you know, you're a busy emergency room doctor and you're trying to fill out this report. And the website, you follow the links, and then the thing times out, and you're back to square one again. And you know, if you're a busy emergency room doctor, you can only spend so many minutes with a system that keeps taking you through a loop and a loop and a loop. And you haven't been able to actually fill out any information, and you spent 20 or 25 minutes trying to navigate a system that seems
right,
to be
right. And they feel that this was, blocks put in on purpose.
It certainly doesn't seem to make sense if you've got if people are interested in urgently knowing if there are in fact any people who are having heart attacks, strokes, cardiac arrests and so on from this brand new vaccine that's just been rolled out, and we've only had 8 months of trial or 8 weeks of trials, that those who don't want to know what, if they don't want to, if they want to gather the data, this would be an excellent way of having that frustrated by having computer systems on a given website for this data to be gathered to be impaired in such a way.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me about that. And thank you for going to the Citizens Inquiry and just making people more aware of what's going on. I really appreciate it. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you want to get to? I give you time to bring up anything.
Oh, I think that's good enough.
Okay, sure. Wonderful. I hate when, people would cut you off, or they'd say, oh, that's all the time we have for now, right? Or you got 2 minutes, wrap, it's like I almost turn the show off when I hear a host like that. So I just always want to make sure that, by the way, if there was something I forgot, no problem. But I'm sure I'll talk to you again. So, until next time, keep up the good work. And once again, I'll make links to your page, Unanswered Questions, and there's an author's page and a couple things with your name. But it seemed to me you were writing for a magazine that printed a few of your articles as well.
Yes, I've had Covert Action Magazine, Propaganda and Focus, a few others that have...
Okay, I'll find something from Covert Action Magazine and that, so people can see that there's many topics you write on.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Len. Great to speak with you again.
Yeah, thank you. So we'll talk again soon.
Take care.
All right. Good night.